Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it is my pleasure to welcome you to this morning's session on controlling healthcare costs. I want to remind you, though, about next week's session, also a topic very much in the news, and that is on the sales tax issue. So you'll want to make sure and, you know, read all of the coverage and think about that topic for next week's panel discussion. So that will be next week. And so without further ado, this morning, TMR member Tony Maxwell, who is Associate Director of Catholic Charities here in Syracuse, will introduce today's guest speaker. And thank you very much, Tony.
Thank you. Good morning. It is with a great deal of pride that I introduce my friend Debbie Freund to you this morning. And to many, she probably doesn't need a whole lot of introduction. Now, when I told Sandy that I would need at least all morning to do this introduction, she said, she gave me the usual 2 minutes. So what I did was boil down one of the most impressive CVs I have ever seen in my life to just a couple of minutes of highlights. We're very lucky to have Debbie here today. As many of you, if I'm sure all of you know, she is Distinguished Professor of Public Administration and Economics at the Maxwell School. But what I didn't know, and you may not either, she's also a professor of orthopedics and pediatrics at Upstate Medical. Prior to that, she was vice chancellor and provost at Syracuse University and vice chancellor and dean of the faculties at Indiana University of Bloomington. Now, throughout all of this, she's truly a brilliant, hardworking, and generous person. And here's part of the reason I say that. She's held so many positions as professor and assistant professor that I just didn't even try to write them down. And very well qualified she is for those roles, with an AB in Classics, a Master's in Public Health Administration. She's got a Master's in Applied Economics and a PhD in Economics. She is an internationally recognized health consultant serving on boards throughout the world. Among those are editorial boards of 11 journals, and serving as at the same time, she's a visiting professor at, are you ready? Harvard, Stanford, Oxford, London, Australian National, and KO universities. She's, in spite of all of those professional obligations and those incredible accomplishments, Deb has found time to serve on numerous local boards where she gives a great deal of time and expertise, and that's how I know her. Deb is a member of the Board of Directors of Hospice of Central New York, Catholic Charities of Onondaga County, the Mamlius Pebble Hill School, St. Agatha Foundation, and then also finds time to advise on the advisory council of the Golisano Children's Hospital. You know, I really could go on forever, but what you really want to hear is from Debbie Freund, and it is with great pleasure that I introduce her to you now.
It's great to be back at TMR, and it's always great to come because I see so many friends. Alex Holstein just said to me, well, Debbie, what do you do with your spare time? This is something that wasn't on my bio, but in many ways I'm more proud of it. I'm a soccer mom. The child who was up to here and 4 years old when I came almost 11 years ago is 15, a ninth grader, and almost 5'11", so he's my pride. It's really fun to be back at TMR. I've done this a couple times before, although I'm having a senior moment and I couldn't tell you for the life of me what I spoke about. It could be that I'm very stale and that I'm going to give the same speech now as I gave a couple of years ago, or not speech. This is really meant to be a conversation with you. So if I don't answer the questions you're dying to ask, I want you to ask them. We're here to talk about healthcare costs, and I'll first give you some of the data that you're really well aware of. Healthcare costs are about 17% of the GDP. After defense, healthcare is the largest sector we've got. There are 47 million people who are uninsured, going on 16% of all Americans. But what many people don't know is that of those people who are uninsured, about two-thirds of them actually work for employers who choose not to offer them health insurance because health insurance is too expensive for them to add on to their list of benefits offering employees. Large percentage of us have private insurance or are covered by managed care organizations, about 60% of us. And a large fraction, 40%, another large fraction, about 35-40%, are covered by the two government insurers, Medicare and Medicaid. And Medicare is a national program, as you well know, and Medicaid is shared by the federal government and state governments. Many people who are covered by Medicare also have private insurance on top of it, called Medigap insurance. And some people are still in managed care types of organizations. That's another 15% or so. Why is everybody so concerned? Well, healthcare costs. Hi, Peter. I hadn't seen you before. Healthcare costs are rising very quickly in the last couple of years, not in some cases as quickly as before. They ebb and flow. But I'm well into my 50s, and I've been doing this for about 35 years. I don't remember a year where healthcare costs didn't rise several percentage points above the annual rate of inflation. And so as goods and services stay like this, healthcare costs are rising faster. And that's been a great concern to a lot of people because it erodes income. And of course, health insurance, how do we get it? We get it by paying premiums. If we're covered by private insurance and we don't buy that as individuals, which we could, and by the way, if we do, it's very expensive, then our employers pay a large fraction of the premiums, and we pay out of our paychecks a smaller but still large fraction going up and up every year. So private insurance is privately financed. Medicare, you all pay for too, and so do I. It may be not as obvious, but it is financed by essentially an earmark on Social Security taxes. And so those of us who pay into Social Security are paying for Medicare. And there's essentially a trust fund where those taxes go to pay for Medicare, and we come very close every year to exhausting that trust fund. So Medicare is an incredibly important program, and it's suffering the same challenges as the rest of the sectors do. And that's very important to keep in mind. Why? Whether we are consumers, whether we are physicians, whether we run hospitals, whether we run insurance companies, whether we're involved in the hospice movement, we all have work to do if we're going to control healthcare costs. And in most ways, we're all in this together, and that's something I want you to think about. Now, to understand why your premiums are rising, if you understand that, you'll see that there are three components, and we can talk a little bit about why those three components are rising. And then I want to end with, so we'll get to the determinants of why healthcare costs are rising. Then what I want to talk about is try to relate. There are three health reform proposals still being talked about. My crystal ball is very, very murky. I have no idea whether we're going to have any kind of health reform enacted this year. We can take a lottery, and one of us in the room will be right, but it probably won't be me. But I want to end with talking about what the variety of things that are embedded in those three health reform proposals, the new president's plan, the Senate plan and the House plan and what they want to do about health care costs. So here we go. Premiums, it's very simple. You multiply the quantity of service demanded by the price that is paid to a provider, by what you think the intensity of treatment is going to be next year versus this year. Intensity generally refers to the type of technology used to treat you. You add on an administrative fee, you average it over all members of the group, and that's the premium. And that's true whether you're talking about Medicaid, which is completely underwritten by government dollars, and trying to figure out how much it's going to cost, whether it's Medicare or private insurance. So you got to remember Q times P times I. And if you understand why Q is going up, what P has to do with it, and what I has to do with it, then you get an A on my test. So take notes. All right, here we go. What's going on with Q? Why is Q rising? Okay. Whenever we go to physicians as patients, unless we're in managed care that pays differently, our physicians are paid fee for service. And that's a very good system in many ways. But it's not a cost-containing system. It's a good system because there's no other than, and we could talk about this, other than what you have to pay out of pocket, which as it goes up becomes a barrier to your treatment. You go, your physicians are paid, and there's no barrier in what you get. The doctor will do for you, and those charges come in. Now, why does that have anything to do with healthcare costs rising? Well, if you think about it, when you go to Wegmans and you buy oranges or you buy pesto, we love pesto in my house, okay, you know what an orange looks like. You can compare a navel orange to a tangerine. You know exactly what the price is, and you buy them according to how much you like oranges relative to tangerines, okay? Well, in healthcare, we don't have a market like that. And what happens is the price of the tangerine, in this case, the price of going to the doctor or the hospital, is almost invisible to those of us who are patients because we pay each time we go a very small fraction of the cost of that visit. Because we pay less, we use more than we would if the prices were higher. Now, like everything else in life, there's a trade-off. The higher are the prices, the less you use, and you may forego something that you really need. But the fact of the matter is we know that because of the way fee-for-service works, we as consumers use more when what we have to pay out of pocket is lower. And we also know that providers, that doctors and hospitals and so on, when they're paid fee for service, tend to give us more than they would if they're paid less. Or if they were paid a different way, I should say. Don't scratch the part of the notes that say if they're paid less. Doctors are great people. They are health insurers or honorable to, and we as consumers, we want the best. Okay? So if I'm paid fee for service, I use more because the price is low to me. Doctors have an incentive, or providers have an incentive, to offer more to you because there's no constraint on saying they can't. They'll charge for it and they'll get paid for it. So that's what I meant when I said we're all in it together. We all have in our control pieces to the puzzle. So that's Q. Okay, and that has something to do with P. Now, intensity is how intensively, how electronically your visit is. One of the great things about America is whether we're talking about drugs, whether we're talking about new types of x-ray equipment like digital mammography, whether we're talking about the newest implant for your hips, a great majority of all of that is developed right here on American soil, and it's U.S. creativity. But those things are very expensive to develop. And as a result, anything new that comes out is more expensive than the technology it replaces. And as I'll get to a little bit later, if all of that technology really improved how well you did, that money might really be worth spending. But if that technology adds very little to your health, then what you're doing is you're paying a higher P and a higher cost than you might have to do just as well in your health. Okay, so that's important to think about. That's the I. We all want technology. We want all drugs. We are the only, there are only two countries in the world that allow direct-to-consumer advertising. Direct-to-consumer advertising are the commercials you see on TV for the latest drug. Okay, you all know what I'm talking about. Anybody know what the other country is? This is really good for your next game of Trivial Pursuit.
Australia?
Close, but no cigar. Sorry. That's it. It's New Zealand. I'm not sure how you knew it, but you guys got it almost dead on. So we have the best medicinal R&D in this country. We have the majority of the multinational drug companies here. So new drugs are coming out every day. They're more expensive than the drugs that they compete against that were older. Some are really breakthroughs. And if you think about it, if it's a real breakthrough, you want it, and most people are willing to pay for it somehow. But if they're not, they still command a very high price, largely because drug companies who pay for the R&D, it's not the government, have to recoup that cost. So drug costs have been going up too, and I'm sure you've been seeing that, largely to pass on the cost of R&D to you. Now, if you put this Q times P times I together, and you multiply it all together, premiums have been rising every year because P is rising, Q is rising, and I is rising. Got it? Now, how have we paid for that? How many of you have seen your premiums rise or your taxes rise? How many of you have seen the co-payments rise when you go to the doctors? This is the 25, it was 20 bucks last year, it's 25 this year. How many of you remember when you went to Rite Aid to get your prescription filled, okay, and a drug cost you, and a generic cost you $5? Now the generic is 20. How many of you remember when there weren't three tiers of drugs? Okay. These are all things put in place to get us to think about what we're spending. Because every sector's costs have been rising. Hospitals, physician services, drugs, durable medical equipment, wheelchairs cost more under your insurance than they used to because they're better than they used to be. All right, so what can we do about this? What are some of the main things that people, that these health reform proposals are talking about? The first one, taxing health benefits, or the Cadillac plans, as they're called in the House proposal. That's a mystery to people. Many groups like unions are very opposed because this would be a tax on a benefit of theirs that's extraordinary relative to what I'm offered, extraordinary in the good sense or extraordinary in the bad sense. You pick. I'm not deciding. I get great health benefits at Syracuse University, too, but not as rich. Okay, so what's this all about, and why do are people concerned about it? And this does not go for Medicare. Medicare costs are rising because Q, P, and I are rising. Okay, now the government tries to control P, and we'll talk about how they do that in a minute. Okay, but let's talk about private insurance for just a minute, and this is where taxing health insurance fringes comes from. When an employer offers me, when Syracuse University offers me health insurance, it's not taxable to SU and it's not taxable to me. So if the average that they pay out for me is close to 10 grand, which by the way it is, that 10 grand is a benefit to me on which I'm not taxed and SU is not taxed. So health insurance is like anything else. The more I pay for it, the less I buy. Or alternatively, the less I pay for it, the more I buy. So, think about it this way. How much money would I have to earn before taxes, since it's tax-free to me, how much money would I have to earn as a consumer before taxes to pay that 10 grand if I was doing it myself? Well, if I was in the 33% tax bracket, which is about average, okay, I'd have to earn $13,333 to pay for that 10 grand. So that extra $3,333 is invisible to me, and as a result, if I have a chance to buy health insurance package one versus health insurance package two, I buy the one with the better benefits. And the one with the better benefits discounts the price to me and shoots up health care costs more. So all of the plans have talked about taxing health insurance benefits. It's not a very popular idea. It remains in a different form for political reasons in the form of a Cadillac tax in at least one of the bills. And it basically says if you have a bill, if you choose health insurance that is worth more than $15,000 a year, you're going to be taxed on that benefit. And the idea is that will help you, the person who's doing the choosing, think about it more and give you the opportunity to pick a health plan that has less rich benefits. And if you do that, that's likely to drive down the cost. Because the idea is, if you think more closely about what you're going to the doctor for, you'll make better choices about when it's really necessary to go. But like everything else, there are two sides to that story, right? We don't have complete knowledge, and very often our doctors don't either. That is, they don't always know what's wrong with you the first time. You could have a completely baffling disease. So the trade-off is you get less rich benefits and you think more, and as a nation, we'll save money. And there's no evidence, by the way, that if we did that, as a country, as a population, that our health would be any worse. It would be just as good. And if you look at other countries, people's health is just as good, and they pay a lot less. But the kicker is there's always a person out there who's not feeling well, who might go less often to the doctor or might not go, because the cost of that visit will be more when the premium is lower because you've opted out of the Cadillac plan for something less expensive. And that lack, when you don't go and you get really sick, you've missed the opportunity to nip a serious disease in the bud. And that costs more. Okay, so like everything else in life, there are trade-offs. Okay? Health insurance didn't used to be good at covering preventive benefits, mammography, PSA screening, colonoscopy. It's much better now. Why? Why do we want to reduce the price? Why do we want to cover it? Because we can detect disease earlier and can save money. So we know that there is a delicate balancing act between wanting to drive P up so that we use our health care better, more cost effectively, and keeping the barrier high when people really need to go. So at least with preventive services, the whole idea is keep the price low so people use it. And believe it or not, people don't, even when they're almost completely insured. I don't know your name. Is it Kay? I can barely see that far, but Kay goes, what? People would do that? Yeah. All right. There's a lot of evidence that patients don't get the right care at the right time. In a lot of places, people get too much, and believe it or not, in a lot of places, people get too little. Both of them are costly. Why? If people get too much, that means you can pour medical care and medical care and medical care at somebody and not improve their health. You're wasting those resources, even a person who could be using them on groceries, who could be using them to help finance their kid to go to SUNY Binghamton or whatever. Of course, there's another side of that. If you get too little, and it would really matter, it's your health at stake, and healthcare costs can rise simply because you got too little, and you pay for it with a hospital visit that could have been avoided. Okay? So it's very important to do something called get healthcare variations under control. When we know what really works, it's important that it's delivered to us or offered every time. And we're really far away from that. And not to offer it when it's not needed, but to offer it when it is. Okay? Now, there's often a threefold variation in costs for the same disease after you've taken out the fact that, you know, delivering services in New York City is more expensive there than it is here because rent on a physician's office is higher there. Everybody gets paid more as they should, otherwise they couldn't live in New York City, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? But when all is said and done, we have to think about that variation. Oh, a number of years ago, there was a group called the Center for Studying Health System Change that was doing, that has studied for years sort of what's going on in the local healthcare communities. Syracuse was one, and there were about 10 others. There are other communities who do worse than we did. But when they looked at 10 tests that, if they were done, could prevent disease later, on average, Syracusans got that only 77% of the time. So there's room for improvement. We have to go and take it seriously. Our doctors have to think about that stuff. And very often, they're not paid for it. And we simply have got to do things, and I'll talk about electronic medical records in a minute, as a potential cost-saving and quality-improving thing. So taxing health benefits was the first thing you'll see. Talking about changes in fee-for-service, getting away from fee-for-service, is something that in this country, we've talked about for the last 25 years. Now, Medicare was the first to move away from it in hospitals. It used to be if you went to the hospital, a hospital would send a bill to Medicare or to your local health insurance plan, and that bill would be paid no matter the cost. Medicare has led the way and enacted something in the early 80s called diagnosis-related groups, so that hospitals are paid now based on the principal reason you're admitted plus what else is wrong with you. Okay, so they get in what you would say is a package price for that hospitalization based on what's the matter with you. Okay? And so the idea there was hospitals, doctors, and nurses would collaborate to think about what are the best treatments. And because each day in the hospital would cost more, what's happened is people get good care, the length of stay has gone down, and we've saved money in the Medicare program over what it would have been had we retained the old cost reimbursement system. Like everything else, anything can be gamed. So the one problem with DRGs is something that we call quicker and sicker. You can remember that. People are discharged from the hospital quicker. Somebody who would have stayed for a week now probably stays 4.5 days. But they're discharged sicker. But our markets worked, and now we have a burgeoning home health sector and long-term care sector. We have hospices that we didn't have 30 years ago. We didn't. 25 years is about, Peter's 25 years ago, is that about right? So there are alternatives, and by and large, it's worked. But it's because people are being discharged quicker and sicker, Medicare saved money that they wouldn't have. Electronic health records. You'll see that in health reform. You won't see much change in the reimbursement system in health reform. The idea of electronic medical record is to make it easy for a physician, when he or she's treating you, to know what drugs you're taking, to know what happened before if you went to somebody else. So what it's supposed to do is connect all of your health care into one electronic record that anybody who's treating you can see. If they did, we would pick up all kinds of iatrogenic diseases, for example, things that happened to you because we didn't know somebody else prescribed medicine A that interacts with medicine B, for example. We're very far away from having the system up and running. I don't know how many of you here are involved in the health collaborative but have heard about it, but we're a leading community in New York State in talking about getting electronic records into our physician offices. They can save lives, and they can save money if they reach their potential. And that's another thing that you see allocated extra money in these health reform proposals to bring that down. What they haven't done yet is embed quality improvement right in electronic medical records. Remember this notion that a lot of people don't get what they should get at the right place at the right time. Well, there's a lot of evidence that mammography will pick up an early breast cancer, right? And that women, there's now a controversy about when women are supposed to get their first one. But a lot of people don't like to go. If you get to our age, last year could have been 5 years ago, if you know what I mean. And you can embed right in electronic medical record a reminder, it's Debbie Freund's turn to have her annual mammogram. And it's more likely if your physician, if it comes up on his screen or her screen, to remind you that you'll get it and you'll do it. So there's a lot of hope. We're not there in terms of having it be realized. Another thing that's in these health reform proposals deals with the uncertainty and tries to deal with what really works and what doesn't, so that we have more information about whether to use the newest technologies, the newest drugs, or not. And that's called comparative effectiveness research. Comparative effectiveness research basically says, take several treatments where we don't, where that are aimed at controlling or curing a particular medical problem. We're not, there's a lot of uncertainty in medicine. We know a lot about what works. We know even less about what doesn't. So there are a lot of holes in our physicians' medical knowledge, and it's no fault of their own. The research hasn't been done. So embedded in all the health reform proposals are money for comparative effectiveness, where you can compare treatment A, treatment B to treatment C and see what works best on average and in what circumstance, so that we can focus on getting that treatment to a person at the right time and not the one that doesn't work. Okay? So, finally, the only other thing that's really being talked about in health reform are two things. First, I haven't talked much about managed care. We don't have traditional HMOs in this area. That's why I didn't talk about them. But some of you are in managed care plans that are called Medicare Advantage. These are great deals. You get everything. They are prepaid plans. If you're in Medicare, you get everything. Now, the way the premium that the government pays to a health insurer that offers that plan works is that they approximate the total amount of care you would have gotten had you been in fee-for-service. And that's what Medicare Advantage plans are paid. The trouble is, the evidence is, and we could talk about why this is, but that's really not, we don't have time. The trouble with it is that on average, people who join Medicare Select plans are less sick than people who stay in fee-for-service. So if you think about that, that in essence means that those managed care plans are overpaid. So one of the things that's in health reform bills, all the health reform bills, the three of them, is to chop, okay, is to chop what Medicare Advantage is paid by about 25%, what those premiums are. There are also proposals to chop the price, what physicians are paid under Medicare. Now, by the way, I don't think that will work because there's all kinds of evidence that the lower is the payment, the higher are the number of services, Q, that you're offered, and the higher is I. So that's not going to do anything other than control what the government pays for Medicare by shorting physicians. They have to earn a living just like we do. Finally, medical malpractice. This has been added at the last minute under the theory that a lot of testing and unnecessary things are done to us so that if there's a bad result, a physician won't be sued. That's a nice theory. There's not a whole lot of evidence that it's right, that malpractice has a lot to do with healthcare costs rising. Certainly not like fee-for-service, which people, every health economist believes is the major culprit. That's not fun for me to hear as a consumer. It's not fun for doctors to hear. Okay, but we all believe that's the major culprit. Malpractice is not close to that, but it's in there, and look for it. So, where have we gone? We know P and Q are rising. We know why, I hope. We've talked about some of the major things that are going to be done. There's not going to be a whole lot done about payment because the payment system we have now is very popular. Okay? And this is why many critics of the health reform plans believe that there's not enough cost containment in the plan. Advocates for health reform say the best thing is that people who are uninsured will be insured. And when they are, two things will happen. They'll get more preventive care. They'll stay at hospitals more. But the insurance effect is such that use will go way up anyway. So I'm pretty dubious, by the way, about whether access is cost-saving, but I think it's a very important thing. So critics of health reform tend to come out and say, we're not doing our job in trying to think about how to control health care costs in all these plans, and I'm not going to vote for it, even though they say we know how to do it. So hopefully your A on the test will mean that you know a little bit more about why we've had health care costs rising, what might be done about it, and as this debate in Washington unfolds, you'll look at those three or four things regarding health care costs and controlling them that are in the bills, and you'll see if they remain or not. So now it's your turn. I've been the ham for too long. It's your turn to ham it up, too. Questions?
I have a quick question. You mentioned we're one of only two countries that allow advertising, direct advertising to consumers. Is there any talk about changing that, or is there any evidence that that leads to increased use?
There is evidence that it does lead to increased use. I haven't heard about anything, any proposals to stop doing it. Okay. It's Sarver's turn.
Thanks for your excellent talk. I'm wondering, you mentioned the effectiveness treatment or the studies in terms of effectiveness treatment. Will there be dimensions there that will measure those different results against the whole concept of futility? And is futility at all relevant to age-based kind of rationing?
Boy, you set me up with a... I think what... Let me turn it around, Peter, since you're the expert. You better define for everybody what you mean by futility, and then I will definitely answer. I'm not trying to duck his question.
Well, futility is where there is no hope for effective diminishment of symptoms or attacking the underlying disease. In other words, the treatments that are being given essentially become a placebo to address the psychological and the social needs of the patient and family.
Obviously, I knew what futility was, but I thought it was important for other people. We know there are very hard decisions that families have to make when somebody has a potentially fatal disease and in their last years of life. Those families often don't know what the comparative effectiveness, what previous research shows. People make different decisions at different times. It is true, we know this from research, that home health given by families is often as effective as if we pay for home health from the outside. It means that a mom and a daughter, a mother and a daughter, a son and a husband are home taking care of their elders. Okay? We know that we would save a lot of money as a country if we didn't give futile treatments. But I have not seen any proposal, because it's such a touchy subject, I've seen no proposal that says anything like, if you have disease X, we won't pay for Y, that we know is ineffective. We don't have the will in this country, at least not now.
Would you say a word or two about whether or not the profits of insurance companies and drug companies have anything to do with the rising cost?
Sure, I will. That's a pretty difficult thing to answer, and the dynamic is different whether you're talking about the pharmaceutical industry or the health insurance industry. I think the answer is they do, but it's not a direct effect. Let me explain what I mean. In the case of the pharmaceutical industry, the majority of drug R&D is done in the United States, okay? And because we don't have national health plans that pay less for any given drug than we do, okay, they free ride on us. So other countries like England, even if a drug is approved there versus here, they'll pay less to have that same prescription filled than we do. Okay. Now, when we buy a pharmaceutical, that's paying back a pharmaceutical company for the R&D that they did. Does everybody understand? Okay. And the way they earn it back is to do that, plus to tack on, in essence, a profit factor. Okay? So I'm trying to simplify it a great deal. What we pay, either through our insurance, in other words, when I go and I have a prescription paid at Rite Aid, I don't pay the whole cost. If I pay $80 for my asthma drug, anybody else take Advair Diskus, the purple thing for asthma? Okay. It's advertised on TV. That's right. Actually, I just moved to Symbicort. Well, that cost me $80 out of pocket, okay, when I have it filled, and then SU pays probably another $300 for that per month for me. Okay? Now, profit is embedded in there. And it's largely a philosophical discussion to say how much profit should be in there. But the answer is it's in there, so it does contribute. All right? In the case of health insurers, where health insurers add administration, in other words, it costs when your doctor sends a bill because Debbie Freund has been to Lou Green for a doctor visit. Many of you know Lou. I go to Lou. When he sends it in, and a health PAMCO pays it, there's an administrative fee. It costs them money to pay it. Okay? Here's what we know. Administration, okay, is more costly in the for-profit health insurance plans and in non-profit health insurance plans. Every health insurance plan is trying to keep those costs down. But there is an element of price rise, and it comes through administration. Okay? I hope I answered your question.
I have the general impression that the drug companies spend more for advertisement than they do for research. I'm not sure if I'm right on that fact.
You're not correct on that. I can't give you the figures. I'm having another senior moment, so I can't give you the figures. That's not correct. But it clearly is true that pharmaceutical companies pay more for advertising on TV than they did in the past when that wasn't allowed.
It is said that the Medicare cost, administration cost, is 1% of whatever, of the gross national, of the cost of health care. The profit-making organization's insurance cost is 4%. Now, that 3% difference is hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars. Why is it that just the claim, do you want the government to run your health insurance? I certainly do, because they can do it more effectively than private companies can do it.
Okay. I haven't heard the problem phrased that way, so let me phrase it in the way where I know the statistics, but it's getting at the same issue. The average administrative fee, or the cost of administering Medicare, is about 3 or 4%. The cost in nonprofit insurance is about 12%, and in for-profit, maybe about 15%. So what the gentleman is saying, and I'm sorry, I don't know your name. What's your name?
John.
What John is saying is it's in essence four to five times higher in the private sector than it is in public insurance. We don't. It's a very complex debate to decide whether we want to have, we could continue to have a system of private insurance or a system of public insurance, where in essence, Canada has in essence the same system we do, with some differences. It is less expensive for Medicare because they are one huge insurance company and it's economies of scale. Okay? People who don't want a single payer like Medicare to be our single payer, which obviously was an option in essence under some of the health reform plans. It was called the public option, but it, you know, wasn't politically viable, so it's basically not there anymore. Would have been cost saving. It isn't the American way. But there's something that isn't talked about very much either. And like an economist, if you remember Economics 101, economics is really about choices and trade-offs. If we got rid of private insurance, or we got rid of hospitals by merging them, for example, we would lose employment. It's a very common thing that in small communities lose their hospitals, okay? And they also lose their largest insurer. So like anything else, it's a very, very complicated thing. And every reasonable person in this room, which includes, I think, everybody, would come down on that issue very differently. I don't know what is the right thing to do. But what I can tell you is I don't think we have any stomach or inclination in this country to move to a solely public.
I wanted to echo what you said about people not taking advantage of preventive care. Of the 300 employees that we have insured through our company in five states, we had less than a third have a doctor's visit last year. And so this year we are paying everyone to go to the doctor, and they're still not going. And it's just interesting.
It's very, the whole thing is incredibly complicated. You could get another professor up here and tell you.
But my main concern, and I'd like you to comment on it, is the cost to the employers with the new health care. Number one, from what I read, pre-existing conditions are going to have to be accepted right away. All states have national medical support orders. They want people on Child Health Plus, or in Iowa it's Hawkeye, to be carried by the employer. So yesterday I had to put a child on who is under Medicare, and we become primary. That automatically will probably raise our rates through Excellus because of higher costs. I don't think it's right for the employers to be saddled with these high rates that are going to come out of this insurance.
Like everything else, you're actually asking two questions, or made some very good, really important comments, I think, to think about. So you've talked about pre-existing conditions. I didn't raise that. That's a very touchy subject, but this is one that's common to all the health insurance proposals. It's a very frequent occurrence that if you change jobs and you have a pre-existing condition, so like my asthma, if I changed to another employer from SU, I might not be covered for my asthma. Okay? In other words, that insurer is not going to be saddled with that cost, and there are a lot of reasons for that. But the idea is, take that away, because because it becomes a barrier to cost-saving treatment. Now, the whole basic question you're asking about loading all these extra costs onto an employer, okay, which is from a variety of reasons, because They want you to pay Child Health Plus, which was one of the examples you gave. Like any other system, there are always hidden taxes. Okay? This is one of them. And it comes down to this. If we want to have everybody to pay for have health insurance, which is what all these extra bills are about, somebody has to pay for it. Okay? The government doesn't want to pay for it. Therefore, it's going to be an employer, or it's going to be us as individuals. I can't tell you if that's fair or not, but that's what's going on. Somebody's got to pay the bill. If it's going to end up being the government, okay, in other words, the solution would be not to have your company pay for that. If it's going to be the government, we pay it. Anybody know why? How? Taxes, okay? So once again, it's hidden. The debate's going to be how and who shoulders those costs. Somebody's got to pay for it. So right now it's hidden. We don't talk about these things very much. But you know what? It's right there, right in our tax.
As always, we run out of time. There are always more questions than we have time for. I want to remind everybody. She'll hang around. Also remind you that we'll be broadcast on WCNY-FM on Sunday at 7 and then posted to their website after that. And thank you, Dr. Freund. Thanks, Debbie, for being with us.